elements or subtle aspects of the understanding of the top subject. So it requires particular language. I'd like to take the opportunity to finish off the class that I gave the other day. That's the benefit of giving more than one class in a week. You can patch up your weaknesses, mistakes or incompleteness. And the other day in the class that I gave, I introduced the class by defining the term or referring to a definition of the term of dharma that was given by one of the presenters, one of the speakers at a conference or a book launch that I attended in New Delhi a couple of weeks back. And I didn't finish off that I didn't explain really why I introduced that term, dharma, or completely finished it off. So the reason why that was presented in this context of this overall is because of it's a definitional thing, and that's come to the point of today, that I mentioned that the opening speaker of this book launch and this conference, he was presenting the complexity in attempting to define many Sanskrit terms, particularly the word dharma, and saying how that this word it's not complete to translate this word as religion, as Srila Prabhupada oftentimes said, although oftentimes translates it as religion, but more oftentimes prefaces his translation by saying this is an incomplete rendition of the word dharma, that it's an essence or it's something which is unchangeable, part of an idea or concept or a being, of our being. And this presenter, he's saying that this dharma is, that's where they leave it. They can't give a real definition of dharma. And my point was that I added something to his presentation, that I acknowledged his understanding that it was incomplete, but I gave a further addition to his presentation based on Srila Prabhupada's knowledge that he presents in Gita, Bhagavatam, that a definition of this dharma then is its innate quality of a substance, the innate quality of a being, of a thing. And Prabhupada often referred to this innate quality or defined dharma analogously in terms of heat, a fire. What is the dharma of fire is heat and light, or the dharma of water is its liquidity. And so the dharma of the jiva is seva. And that's where I wanted to wrap up that particular presentation class. But it was a bit of a muddle, as most of my classes are, but particularly when I'm asked to do class during Guru Puja, it's more of a muddle. And we're progressing because I was asked to give class during japa time, so it's less of a muddle, hopefully. Anyway, that's a definitional reference to the word dharma, is that it's our essential being, and our essential being is seva, is to do service to God. And that will complete the whole, part and parcel. We're going to talk about what this word part and parcel means today. Because it's a term, I believe, coined by Prabhupada. If it's not coined by Prabhupada, definitely popularized by Prabhupada and brought into the main mainstream of language by Srila Prabhupada, as many of his terms were. And if you can just imagine, or if you just think about when Srila Prabhupada was writing and for whom he was writing. Of course, he's writing for the next 10,000 years. He's writing for past, present, and future. But in the social context in which Prabhupada was writing, it was very progressive, you can say, or regressive in one way. But it was a time of turmoil, social turmoil, and political turmoil in many, many countries, post-Second World War. The heart of Vietnam War, and so global contention over wars that don't need to be fought, freedom, equal rights, equality, egalitarianism at its maximum. So within this context, Srila Prabhupada appears. And if you study Prabhupada's memoirs, or if you study Srila Prabhupada in the context of his biographies by different devotees, you'll read and you'll understand and begin to appreciate the brilliance of Srila Prabhupada, how he came with this philosophy and how he came with this explanation and how he came with this language. And his prayer was answered. His prayer on the Jaladutta in Boston Harbor, that please, you know, why did you bring me here? Just make me dance, make me dance, make me dance. Make them able to understand this philosophy. How they will understand the Bhagavad philosophy. Most of this population, Prabhupada looked out over the Boston Pier, most of this population is immersed in the mode of ignorance. Tamaguna. Just by looking out of the ship, he could see that. Without meeting anybody, he could see a big cloud of tamagun over Boston. And he was right. And at best, rajagun. So how will they understand this Bhagavatam, this supreme literature, transcendental literature, Nimala Purana? How will they understand this pure Purana of Srimad Bhagavatam, the spotless Purana? So Prabhupada's process was to beg for the empowerment of Srimati Radharani, the empowerment of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to make his words applicable, to make his words accessible, to make his words understandable, that the mass of people could be benefited by contacting with this Srimad Bhagavatam and transform their lives, because it's a transformational process. It's not it wasn't a process for temporary stimulation of the intellect or the senses or the mind, but the whole process of Bhagavatam is that it's not an event, it's a process. It's not, I got my Bhagavatam, I purchased this Bhagavatam, it's my book now, I got this. But the Bhagavatam is something which is not a product. Bhagavatam is an eternal process, cultivation. And it's captured in words, and we contain it within pages of books. But it's an eternal process. It's not something that we acquire. We get this object of Bhagavatam. When we first joined the temple here in Melbourne, many of us joined through university preaching. And we would all, I mean, there must have been at least a dozen devotees who joined this Brahmacharya ashram upstairs who had full sets of Bhagavatam. So in the ashram we had about 15 sets of Bhagavatam. Everybody joined with their Bhagavatams. It was quite interesting. Yadu had Bhagavatam, I had Bhagavatam, Atul had Bhagavatam, and everybody who joined the temple had a Bhagavatam. It was practically, you joined the temple with your Bhagavatams. And then after a few years, the Bhagavatams were dwindling. And what happened to his Bhagavatam set? Oh, he sold it at the Sunday feast. What happened to the other's Bhagavatam set? I don't know, Yadu doesn't know what happened to his Bhagavatam. Well, the devotee sold it on book distribution. Started doing those 12 cantos, 10 cantos, 11 cantos, 5 cantos, no cantos. So gradually all of the Bhagavatams got shifted out of the Brahmacharya ashram. They were sold from the Brahmacharya ashram. But we arrived with Bhagavatam, but we hadn't read Bhagavatam. We couldn't really access Bhagavatam. It was like a temple trick. Andy Ruda was out there selling Bhagavatams to everybody, full sets. And every time he sold another full set, that meant he made a brahmachari, or a brahmacharini. So every time he sold a set, he would just follow them up and then tell them to come and say, how's the Bhagavatam going? We wouldn't have a clue what the Bhagavatam was. So if you want to understand the Bhagavatam, you've got to join the temple. So you all come to the temple, join the temple, and bring your Bhagavatams with you. Don't leave them at home. So the point is the language of the Bhagavatam is very unique, and Prabhupada's language is very unique, and he talks in terms of these vocabulary of the cosmic manifestation. I mean, if you lived in the 60s, that's pretty cool language. That was the standard of coolness, right? Cosmic. It was transformational. I mean, today that's cool language. Transformational. External energy. Wow, energy is cool. To talk about energy. Prabhupada's embedded this language. Prabhupada probably popularized this language in the modern vernacular from Bhagavatam, if you believe it or not. If you go through this one page of Prabhupada's and think, wow, this man's really cool, you know, he's like cutting edge. Where does he get this stuff from? The internal energy, the cosmic manifestation. So this word, it may stand objective reality, and these words, they're usually, many times they're used either by experts in a field of a particular department, universities, or by some esoteric writers, some esoteric metaphysical writers that write in science fiction or something like that. They might use this terminology. But Prabhupada is using it in a very lucid way, and in a way that opened up the whole complexity of the Vedic canon of philosophy to common man. There's a concept these days and age in what they call disruptive education systems called shining a light on mastery. Shining a light on the master. So the master is someone who's got a following. The master is someone who's got knowledge. The master is someone who's got advanced skill set in terms of communication and communicating what he has, etc., etc. Not necessarily does he have a PhD from Harvard or Oxford. More and more that's being diminished in terms of importance. But the master should have capacity. The master should have ability to build capacity in himself and in others, inspire others. So this shining the light on mastery is a contemporary it's a contemporary focus for in education in terms of the education marketplace, that we want to attract people to come and listen to these masters, and they'll speak eloquently, and they'll speak with penetrating examples, contemporary examples, and they'll drag their audience in and enable the audience to feel that they can be somehow improved. They can improve their situation by coming in contact with this master in whatever field it is, in hospitality or cooking or whatever it is. So Śrīla Prabhupāda is such a master. He's a master on a level which is, as I say, at whose feet all masters sit, Prabhupāda, at whose feet all masters sit. And we don't say that Śrīla Prabhupāda is expert, because experts keep a very they contain their knowledge, contain their understanding in a particular field. And you might refer to an expert on the national news to get an opinion on an earthquake, or to get an opinion on some forensic expert to get an opinion on some criminal act that's just happened. So you get the expert from the Melbourne University to speak for 3 minutes on the National 9 News. That's an expert. But a master is someone who has taken that language and the knowledge and the understanding and simplified it and codified that for access to the common people. So that they come down from that platform and they're accessible. So Prabhupada we're shining the light on Śrīla Prabhupada's mastery of his language, mastery of his presentation, mastery of his vision to inundate the world with Krishna consciousness through culture, through education, through knowledge. So Prabhupada said in the fourth chapter of the Gita that this Krishna consciousness should be understood by all leaders of society, and all planets, and that they should take this Krishna consciousness and benefit others through culture, education, and devotion, through bhakti, these three things. So what is this material energy of Vishnu that's referred to here? Again, this cosmic manifestation is separated from the Supreme Lord as material energy by means of kala, which is the unmanifested impersonal feature of the Lord. It is situated as the objective manifestation of the Lord under the influence of the same material energy of Vishnu. And in the purport, Prabhupada begins his explanation of this seemingly complex point, which is not really complex, but the language may seem a little alien if we're not used to this particular presentation. Prabhupada says, he refers to Narada Muni in his discussion with Vyasadeva when he arrives in the ashram of Shri Vyasadeva. In the first canto of the Bhagavatam, Idam hi Vishvam Bhagavan Ivetaraha. And there it says that this Ivetaraha means it's the same and different. This energy of the Lord is the same as the Lord, but it's different to the Lord. And then Prabhupada, in that commentary, in the 1.5.20 commentary, he begins to explain, or begins to unpack this idea of a chintya beda abeda tattva, as he does in many places in Bhagavatam, in many places of his presentation, and it's very essential to understanding of our Krishna consciousness philosophy, a chintya beda abeda tattva. And many people who try to understand Krishna consciousness philosophically, maybe from different traditions, or from a scholarly point of view, or from a different angle than pure devotion from our Bhagavatam, they understand quickly that in order to connect with Krishna consciousness, the philosophy, they have to understand the Chintya Beda Beda Tattva, because that's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's culmination of his present of Vedanta. That's his own unique presentation of the Veda, is Achintya Veda Veda Tattva, that we're simultaneously one with God and different. And Prabhupada went to great lengths to explain and to clarify the oneness and difference of the jiva, the qualitative and quantitative. Another two other terms Prabhupada used very masterfully to explain our relative position in connection with the Supreme. Qualitative and quantitative. Those who do research in the universities, they'll understand that this qualitative research and quantitative research, is the quantitative research is they're crunching data and information, and they're getting so-called hard facts and information that can be analyzed and can be synthesized, and we can break this down, and we can develop a hypothesis based on our observation and our crunching of the numbers. What did we get? What's the information? What do we know now? And how do we weigh this up on the scales? What will we conclude from this information, this quantitative research? And this is solid, this is scientific. It must be. We've observed it. It must be real. Like the Greek people. In Melbourne's got a very big Greek population. And they had a famous newspaper here. I think it was called Il Globo. And if a Greek lady, if a Greek person read something in Il Globo, it was true. I said, whatever it was. I said, how did you find that out? We have many Greek friends. How did you find that out? It was in Il Globo. Oh, it must be true. It was in the newspaper. It must be true. So, that's a point of reference, that it's scientific. For a Greek person, Il Globo, it must be true. That's the reference. It's a Shastra. Il Globo is Italian. One of the Greek newspapers. Anyway, for the Aussies, that's the Sun and the Age. I read it in the Age. The front cover of the Age, it must be true. Scientific. It's got authority. The Age. Good newspaper. So, that's the essence of Prabhupada's presentation then is that it's qualitatively we are the same as God. We have potential to develop the qualities of God up to, in that purport, Prabhupada says, up to 78%. We can develop these different qualities of the Lord, or in terms of our characteristics, in terms of the transcendental qualities that are presented in Gita, Amanitvam, Adambitvam, Hingshakshanti, Arjavam, in terms of what Gita defines as knowledge, we can cultivate those, and they're in Krishna. They come from Krishna. There's a perfect form of them. They're in Krishna. But they're different to Krishna. Krishna's the same and he's different. And this material world, we become enamored by it, we become this Vishnu Maya. In that purport, in the 1.5.20, he says Vishnu Maya means the external energy of the Lord. That we become enamored by Vishnu Maya. We see it because it's separated. Enamored because we see it different to God. But it's not different to God. And that's the message today. That if we see it different to God, if we see it different to Krishna, it becomes bewildering. Because then we identify, if it's different to God, it's mine actually. It's for my enjoyment. It's for my satisfaction. It's just an arrangement of the material energy for my benefit. And so I should take this and manipulate this and extort this and do whatever I need to do with this for my benefit, for value added for me. But when we see it in terms of relation with Krishna, then it becomes a different story. It's for Krishna's pleasure. It's for Krishna's satisfaction, for his gratification. And then we become peaceful and happy. When it's for me, we become fearful because someone else is after it too. It's competition. Someone else saw that bit of material energy and it's limited bit of material energy. And so there's competition to get that and to extract what we can out of that for my satisfaction, my benefit, and not for others. And that's the... In a nutshell, Prabhupada says that's Krishna consciousness, to conceive things in connection with Krishna. Nibandha Krishna sambandhe yukta vaidagya muchita. That's real renunciation, is to become detached. Our process is not detachment. Our process is attachment. That we have to become attached. Jai Srila Prabhu, who's here recently, he does a parenting course and he does relationship courses for householders and different courses. And one of the courses he does with the householders, he encourages them, you know, he talks to them, new householders, how they're trying to get their head around what it means to be a grihastha. They should be detached. And they shouldn't, you know, like have any affection to each other, and they should live at opposite ends of the house and things like this. So he says, actually, your business is to become attached. Because if you don't become attached to your wife, you'll become attached to someone else's wife. So you become attached to your wife and then learn how to deal with that, with Krishna's energy, and the wife to learn how to deal with the husband. And in that way, become purified of that necessity, of that attraction. Because it's not a real attraction. It's not a false attraction. We're attracted to the opposite sex because of Krishna's energy. It's Krishna's energy. And that's very attractive. Krishna's energy is very, very attractive. And when we see it separated from Krishna, it's a problem. When we see it as Krishna, it's not a problem. It's part of our service to God. It's part of our service to Krishna to engage the material energy, to engage that energy in his service, and we all become connected. So Prabhupada says that in that section, Prabhupada said to Bhaktisukta Damodaramaraj that he wrote these purports in 1.5 purports for the scientific community. And Bhaktisukta Damodaramaraj did a lot of work around those purports, particularly 1.5. This is 1.5.20, 1.5.21, 1.5.22. 1.5.22 is a very famous purport there, where Prabhupada talks. He says that the human intellect is developed for to develop for perfection in the arts and physics and science and psychology and history, in any department of knowledge. And he said, this will bring perfection to human society. And he says in the next sentence, that perfection to human society leads to a full understanding of the absolute truth. And in this purport, he starts to unpack this idea of connecting with Krishna, everything with Krishna, as a part of kirtan, as a part of service to God. And then he says that when philosophy, when history, psychology, sociology, art, music, dance, literature, when they're used for the service of God, they become perfect. They're actually designed for that. They're designed for the glorification of Krishna, of God. And we see many of the great literatures in the world are glorification of God. And many of the great art pieces, or many of the great musical masterpieces, are glorification. Or somehow or other they're connected with God, with the chapel, with the whatever it is, Sistine Chapel, or the Renaissance artists that were painting. Their subject matter was glorification of God. And that is so very much in India. While we were in Delhi, we met this young girl from America. She's living in Vrindavan now, and she's studying an art form of Odissi dance form. And she wants to present this to the world as the perfection of the art form is glorification of Jagannath. The perfection of this art form is to glorify Krishna through movement, through posture, through mudras, and through movement of the body in time with particular music. She's expressing love for God in a very, very artistic form, a very, very refined form. And it takes elements of Bharatanatyam in different forms, but all of the art forms in India, all of the dance forms, she's been studying for a few years. She was explaining to us that all of the dance forms they're all got one shastra that they go back to. So that and the purpose is to glorify God. That's what it's for. The art form is to glorify Krishna. All of the Shilpa Shastras, the Kala Shastras, all of the Shastras, Vastu Shastra, it's for God. To make a perfect arrangement for God. To make a beautiful architecture for God. One of the great Vastu pundits, he was defining what is Vastu Shastra. Vastu is the science of understanding how to place things in a house or a building for peace and harmony. So he said that Vastu means something which is, if you don't have, understanding of what's where and which direction is what and where is the southwest and where is the northeast, then he said Vastu also means beauty and elegance. And that's an element of Vastu. It might not be in the right place. It might be all upside down and topsy-turvy. But if a form of a building has beauty and elegance and functionality, he said then it can be Vastu compliant, even if it's not in the right direction. Maybe you won't get as many customers or as much money or whatever, but it can still be can still vibrate with energy, positive energy. So that's one of the all of the aspects of the Vedic knowledge is to connect it back with God, and it's for glorification of God. And Prabhupada concludes that 1:5:20-22 verse purport with the statement that philosophy, psychology, literature, dance, music, when they're all used in the service of God, factually they become Hari Kirtan, that is Sankirtan. To do that for Krishna is a form of Kirtan, 24-hour Kirtan, whatever you have. It's a Kirtan Mela. It's a Kirtan Mela. If we do what we do for God, it's Kirtan. And that's a very powerful statement that Prabhupada made. And it's something it's the kind of the inspirational sutra or the inspirational philosophical focus in that purport that we use for encouraging all educational pursuits. Because sometimes people say that education, Prabhupada didn't want us to learn mundane subjects. That's Maya. It's Vishnu Maya, and we use it in Krishna service. It becomes transformed. Becomes a kirtan. So it's not Maya. But we became so paranoid that it was Maya, that and we thought that the best service we could do was just to teach our kids kirtan and the bhajans of Narottam Das Thakur and holy places and Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, and it was good. But without teaching English and mathematics, it was lopsided. So we're trying to rectify, we're trying to balance the scales. Right? And not the other way. There's a tendency for this pendulum swing to say, now it should just be all materialistic knowledge, and you just get Krishna consciousness when you come for darshan in the temple, that's enough. But we need balance. We need to learn how to read and write. Nothing wrong with learning to read and write. And we need to learn how to calculate. And we need to learn how to interact with other people, other human beings, and other species on the planet. And a little philosophy, a little history, a little geography to understand where we are in time and place. So the Prabhupada says so we're not considered to be fools. And we need to have a strong understanding to connect everything with Krishna. Like when Jagatmohini Mataji was speaking on the Sunday, one of the young girls in the congregation, Sweta, she made a presentation. It was very nice. Her contribution at the end of the class, she gave some very practical understanding or realization of what it was like to grow up in the community. You know, not fully in the, like, 24/7 in the ashram, but in the community. And her realization was that it just required a little bit of tweaking and little skill, a little technique on how to interact with people in order to stay grounded, in order to stay fixed, in order to stay peaceful in her other environments that she would interact with. And she had a very practical, you know, solution to it. Not, you know, wow, you know, deep philosophical, psychological analysis. This is what we have to do because otherwise we'll all become traumatized with this dilemma between matter and spirit. But something very simple. It's not so traumatic. It's not so wow. It's just something that she said. Well, if somebody asks you at school, because one of the big dilemmas when you interact with people from outside, and on the outside, is, you know, say, well, what did you do on the weekend? And, you know, they're going to say, oh, I went to the footy. Or, you know, I went to the pub or something like that. Went to a party. Had a good time at a party. So they're going to say, well, these things. And so what is a 16 or 17-year-old going to feel like? No, I didn't go to the footy. I didn't go to the party. They're going to feel like ostracized. They're going to feel like different. They're going to feel like freaks. So they're going to start to want to go to the footy and do stuff. But she said, I just said to my friends, I spent the weekend with family and friends and, you know, enjoyed myself. And the details. Went to the temple. In fact, plenty of family and friends at the temple. And so it's just a matter of becoming a little bit conversant with the ways of interacting and thinking things through so that we can articulate who we are and what we are and do it with strength of conviction, strength of mind. And that conviction is a more powerful preaching tool than anything. We had one of our students who graduated from the school in Auckland. He left the school when he was 13. He went to high school, first year in high school, 14 years of age. And our school goes through to year 8. He went to high school and he wore his tilak first day. I said, what are you wearing tilak for in this, like, school? 2,500 kids in the school. And he's wearing tilak. One of 2,500 kids. So he stood out. And he said, well, I'm a devotee. I wear tilak. I wake up in the morning, I take bath and I put on tilak. And he said, I'm not going to hide that I'm a devotee. Why should I hide that I'm a devotee? And he said, and the people, we said to him, how do you feel about that? And after 3 months at the school, we thought he'll rub it off pretty quickly. But he put on bigger tilak. After 3 months, put more tilak. Far out. And then he put the seeker. He went there one day with shaved head and seeker and tilak. After the first time. I thought, wow, he's getting serious, this guy. His name was Puneet. Here's a pretty unique kid, very small, right? And very, you know, not like wow, super scientist and intelligent, but intelligent guy. And he was on the roster for giving class. And if you go into the class roster in Auckland and say, you know, Kala Samavara, it's got all the days. Who's doing what class for the Sunday feast for the whole year? It's Kala Samavara Das, Pranda Das, and, you know, Ishvara Das, different devotees, Das, Das. And then it's got Puneet Prabhu. They're like, who's Puneet? Who's this Puneet Prabhu? Here's a kid in the school. He's 12, 13 years old. He's giving Sunday feast lecture in the temple in front of 300 people. So he's in the school, in the high school, and he said, the reason why I put tilak and shave is because then the people who are interested, they come and sit down next to me and ask me, what's a tilak? Why? What's this seeker for? What do you do? And so he said all the time he's preaching at school. But he doesn't go and preach to people. The people come to him and ask him, and he just talks. So he said every day he's never alone. Everybody's interested. Who is this kid? He's different to everyone else. So sometimes I was talking to Jagatarini Mataji about this, not about Puneet, but about hiding our Krishna consciousness. Sometimes we don't have to hide it as much as we think we have to hide it. We can be much more bold about being Krishna conscious, and particularly in Australia. I mean, it's a very open country. I went to a meeting yesterday in Collins Street, 350 Collins Street, so I didn't go as a devotee. Usually I travel around in Dodia, but I didn't go in there. I thought it might freak a few people out. So I went in there and I was waiting for the person to come out, the big head honcho, and he comes out of his office and he says, Prana, where's your robes? He says, oh, I thought you would have come. I told everybody that there's a Hare Krishna coming today and everybody's looking out for this guy in robes. That's why they didn't greet you properly. I thought you would have your robes on. Because he met me in Mumbai and he came to our offices in Mumbai and we were just all dhotis and saris, and he was let down yesterday. This is a true story. Mahavan, our son, he went to work at a big wireless provider, internet provider in Auckland. He worked there for about 8 months. And he went there undercover. He didn't want anyone to know he's a Hare Krishna. You know, it's one of these companies where Friday afternoon it's drinks and everything like this. So they knew he didn't drink. They knew he didn't do all these things. So the last thing was he didn't want to say he's a Hare. You know? Then he's hiding his identity as a Hare Krishna for so many months. And then for a year. And then one morning he goes to the temple for Radhastami. And he goes in Dhoti for Mangalati. We all come from Mangalati. And he's playing Mridanga. He likes to play the Mridanga. The Lord is like him to play with him. So he's playing Mridanga during the Mangalati. And you know, Mangalati, everyone's half asleep or three quarters asleep. No one's looking around, shaking his like some sort of stuff. So he's playing Mridanga half asleep. And then someone's playing Kartan next to him half asleep. But nicely, you know. It sounds nice, but still half asleep. And afterwards, when the light goes on, you know, everyone puts their head up. Everyone puts their head up. And then he looks up, and the person playing Kartal was his boss at work. And Sandeep said to him, Michael! Because he's there in his dhoti. One ear is hiding. And then Mahavan says, Sandeep! Sandeep had a dhoti on, right? His boss. And then I'd met Sandeep. I didn't know there was any connection between, you know, I'd met him a few weeks ago. He's just a brand new devotee, right? And after about 3 weeks, he put a dhoti on. I said, how to put the dhoti on? And he said, oh, I learned how to put it on YouTube this morning. It looked like it too. I said, well, I fixed him up a bit. But they met like this in Mangalati. Another instance happened. So two people in that organization, and it wasn't a big organization, were actually devotees, and the whole time he's like hiding, you know, I don't want anyone to know that I'm a devotee. And then half the company are devotees. So we can be quite bold, you know, about our Krishna consciousness in the right way, in the right time, in the right place. And that's something that Srila Prabhupada's given us, an understanding that we become aware of the connectedness with everything. And it demystifies the material energy. The material energy becomes more a part of our service to Krishna. It's not something to be fearful of. It becomes something that we're we're grateful for material energy, and we utilize it in a balanced way, in a way that is glorifying of Krishna, not negating of Krishna, that he's not mine. Questions or comments before everybody evacuates? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Sorry for overshooting the time. It was a slow start. I finished Jai Radha Madhava with 3 devotees in the temple room. To be a little bit not lenient on ourselves, but that we can develop our Krishna consciousness in a peaceful and in a joyful, even joyful way. That would be something that's good preaching. If the devotees are smiling, if we come to the temple and we're all got our head down and we're sad, then it won't be very attractive. Right? So the balance, how to glorify Krishna and not always focus on the glorifying ourselves. I think if we become more, we become more realistic about Krishna consciousness. First of all, we're very fanatical about it because we got something new and it's something exciting and it's, you know, intensely different to what we experienced before. And that part of that kind of conversion, it's almost mandatory. The default of a conversion is fanaticism. Utsaha mayi, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says. That we become puffed up with enthusiasm. We're too great, and everyone else is not great. But pretty soon, Krishna's different energies put us into place, as Krishna does. His different agents, and then it's a matter of plateauing and sort of putting things in a perspective, and that perspective comes through good association, through, you know, finding out people that we can feel comfortable with to express our doubts and to deal with our doubts, because we all have doubts, and if we just keep we just bottle up our doubts, we might, they may just take over. And we may just become overburdened by them and bewildered. So someone who we can express our doubts to, someone who we can exchange the loving exchanges with. And that will enable us to stay kind of fixed on the right path and not to be too harsh on ourselves for our shortcomings and our failings. But at the same time, not to be over lenient too, and to say, "Well, that's all right. I don't have to go that hard so fast. It'll come eventually." But we do have to extend ourselves in Krishna consciousness and to try to keep the balance between eking out a comfortable position for ourselves and exerting ourselves, turning up the gas a little bit on the tapasya, where we can maintain, we can keep it, but without some form of austerity, the realization will be minimized. It's yayatama prapadyate. As we surrender, we get more and more understanding. So I guess the path, keeping it in balance, is through association, through good association, keeping it real, is by checking in with our peers and serving our seniors, being respectful, praying for that understanding and that mercy. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, when we properly honor all living beings, first of all he says, that give me a drop of mercy so that I can not always seek out to glorify myself, but that I can be in a proper position and properly honor all living entities. Only then will we sing the holy name in great ecstasy, when we can do that. To give up desire for personal honor, but to give that honor and glory to Krishna. Varni gunanu kartane shavano kutayam. That's our internal mantra that we should be considering. That's a transformation of Mani Grivan and Nanda Kuvera. Is that they got the realization after thousands and thousands of years in bodies of trees, which have very little consciousness. That when they saw Krishna face to face, who was bound by the wooden grinding mortar, they offered the series of prayers, and their conclusion is that now, let me speak to glorify God. We've glorified so many other things before. Now let me do it for God. And let me use my hands, hastoja kamasu manasa paratavayona. Let me use my hands for serving God, my limbs for service of God. Let me put my mind at His lotus feet, at the lotus feet of the Lord. And let me remember Krishna, smrityam shidas tananivasa jagat praname. Let me offer obeisances to all the living entities in the universe, because Krishna is in the heart of the living entities, of the jivas. Actually, the prayer, drishti satam dashane, let me see the Vaishnavas, because when I see the Vaishnavas, I see Krishna. I'm reminded of Krishna. The prayer of Mani Griva Nada Kuvera, they act as our kind of reference point, a compass for us. But that's where we need to get to. That will direct us to our true north, when we can do these things, tick them up. And those things are part of the process of our Krishna consciousness, part of the process of Prabhupada established. If we follow our program that Prabhupada established, then we have a full... We're doing Vani, Gunana, Katani, Shavana, Katayam all the time. We're seeing devotees all the time. We're offering obeisances all the time. We're glorifying Krishna all the time. If we just do this morning program, that's the potency of Prabhupada's program. He made this process so powerful that it's the conclusion of the prayers of all the great sages. It's a process of connecting everything with Krishna.
So this verse says that the cosmic manifestation is separated from the Lord by the time. Mm-hmm. And we can see sometimes when we meditate, you know, we can feel that there is no time, or time goes very quickly. So, and does it mean that basically, if we successful at the meditation and we do not notice that how the time passes, then we rejoin with the Lord? And also, if you consider the state of samadhi as a concentration, it has the same symptoms, that the time, like a person doesn't notice the passage of time, mm-hmm. when like in a deep samadhi. Mm-hmm. So but the state of samadhi, it's not always is connected with the Lord. It can be like a scientist can experience samadhi once it's concentrating on some concept. Mm. So, Yeah, does it mean there are like different stages approaching the Lord? Like, can you like elaborate on that?
Yeah, there are different stages and different stages of samadhi as well. Rupa Goswami talks about different stages of meditation and absorption. And many of the of our contemporary psycho theorists have identified this kind of concept of samadhi in terms of, they call it flow, or they might call it being in the element, being there now, where you become totally absorbed in your activity as an artist or a musician or a scientist or something, and you're cracking a code and you're going through whatever. So you can stay there for, I was with someone last night, they said he does coding for NAB, for the National Bank in Australia. And he loves it so much. I mean, sometimes he loves it, most of the time he hates it, but he can get so absorbed in it that hours can go by. Hours and hours and hours have gone by, and everybody's left the office and he's there by himself and he's got to, you know, do the security lockout because he just got lost and he's trying to figure out where did this missing account go. And when he finds it, he's going to rejoice, but he's going to take 8 hours to find it, and all for the National Bank of Australia. So that's the type of absorption that our psychologists have understood in the workplace. And that's what they want to get. They want to get the people in the workplace to get to this level of flow, so they're productive and they produce, and they do it joyfully. And then, you know, Ken Robinson and others, they've identified this as what they call the element. When you're a skilled person and you have a particular understanding of the subject matter, and you have a passion for that, you have an inclination toward that, and you make your money in that way. Like Jim Collins, it's a hedgehog principle where you got 3 out of 3. You love what you're doing, you're good at what you're doing, and you're making money out of it. So that's considered to be the ultimate, particularly the making money part of it. So that's a full absorption, and that keeps you, you know, absorbed. It's an intrinsic motivator to keep you absorbed there. But it's different to the spiritual absorption. And we have to be careful not to... Becoming absorbed is not spiritual, necessarily. It's not necessary just to become absorbed if it's not connected with Krishna. But connected with Krishna, it becomes purifying. It's not the same as samadhi, always thinking Krishna, but it becomes purifying that we will get to the platform of full internal samadhi where we're always absorbed in Krishna and lila. But we do that through our, you know, connecting, or the red hot iron rod principle of becoming as hot, fired up as the fire. So the samadhi principle is definitely there in the materialists, but our samadhi is that we're aiming for, and we have to do that through the, you know, definitely through our present situation, our psychophysical nature, and when we do that through our psychophysical nature, it's more not convenient, it's just more natural, the flow is more natural. Shrimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Shiva Gopa ki jai.
Thank you.